Welcome to Forums for a Future. No, it's not 1960. It's nearly half a century later. But, once again, there are warnings of danger all over the land. It's time, once again, to reclaim a future that is free of war, racism, and poverty. A brighter future of promise and hope. I am Edward Renner, your host for a series of civic discussions, forums, if you will, toward creating a more viable future. This podcast is similar to a university course. There are three recent books that provide background information and are suggested reading. The complete outline for the podcast and all reference material are available on the Forums for a Future homepage on my website, which is at www.kerenner.com. While each of the individual podcasts is a self-contained piece, taken together, they are a sequential series that build on each other. There is a logical progression, starting with an identification of the issues, moving on to an analysis of how to better understand them, and ending with practical ways to respond to them. It's not sufficient to complain about the present, unless you have a perspective for the future that offers reasonable alternatives. The outline on the Forums for a Future homepage provides the structure for this trip from the present to the future. Podcast number 2, The Conceptual Foundation. In this opening podcast, I will describe the conceptual foundation for the series. There are 4 pillars. First, economic. 2, political. 3, social. And 4th, personal. Our future rests on these 4 interdependent pillars. Like the 4 directions, they are the 4 quadrants that constrain our path from the present to the future. The route must be safe and secure. It must lead to hope and promise. The least we owe our children is to leave them with a future no less hopeful than we were given. The first 3 pillars are well represented by recent best-selling books. First, The World is Flat by Thomas Friedman. Second, Future Tense by Gwen Dyer. And 3, Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed by Jared Diamond. Each author, respectively, from an economic, political, and social perspective, outlines how the modern world has brought humankind collectively to the point where people must make significant changes to core beliefs and values if they are to survive in a new era. Forums for a Future provides the basis for a structured discussion of what those significant changes of core beliefs and values are if our children are to have a sustainable future on this planet within their lifetime. This is a personal perspective, and it is the 4th and final pillar. Let's take each pillar one at a time, starting first with Thomas Friedman's book, The World is Flat. This is the economic foundation for having a future. The economic pillar is the easiest one to identify with. Economic issues are the obvious disruptions that are currently in our face. Globalization has changed the nature of work. For example, here in the U.S., we have seen our industrial base go overseas, primarily to China. We have seen corporate retirement plans and benefits sacrificed to cost-cutting measures said to be necessary to preserve American jobs. Sometimes the change produced by globalization is invisible, but sometimes it is startlingly obvious. For example, when you make a telephone call to customer service and discover that you are speaking to someone in India who has introduced him or herself as Frank or Susan, The invisible part is, how did these changes happen? The answer, a shrinking world. A world in which every person on the face of the earth has a growing opportunity to compete for every job, no matter where the person lives or where that job is now. Thomas Friedman called this the flattening of the globe, and thus the title of his book, The World is Flat. Students in India learn English and languages of other countries so that they can compete for jobs in the United States and in those other countries. India's universities train them in computer software, U.S. tax law, or whatever specialty they need. High-speed, inexpensive, digital communication technology made it possible, just like that, for U.S. customer service to be outsourced to India at one quarter of the cost of doing it here. I first became aware of this trend over 10 years ago, when the company my neighbor worked for laid off his staff of computer programmers, real people who he had known and worked with for years, and replaced them all with programmers living in India. Since that day, he started supervising workers in another country who he had never met and would never meet, all with English work names. Much to his surprise, the change worked out fine. The Indians were excellent workers, seldom missed a day of work, and were receptive to feedback, sometimes by telephone, but most often by real-time email. That is when I first started to re-examine everything I then believed about our economic, political, and social institutions. It has been a remarkable journey, with this podcast series being but one step along the way. My neighbor's next surprise came a few years later, when the company abruptly laid him off. The outsourcing had worked so well for his small department that the next step was to outsource an even larger segment of the U.S. company, which included him. That was when I fully grasped the realization that a remarkable, fundamental economic change was taking place. The change was moving at a speed faster than what any individual could keep up with. The workers in India had started their preparation and training for the transition my neighbor faced more than a decade before it actually happened. But in 2 short years, first his staff, and then he himself, was out of work. Those 2 years were far too short of time span for any of them to have done anything to prepare themselves for the unemployment that they then faced. None of them even saw the change coming. Even my friend, who 2 years before saw his staff get fired. The lesson is clear. Whatever you now believe about the economic capacity and future for yourself or for the United States that is based on what has been true in the past is suspect and potentially dangerous to your future economic well-being. No current future, no current value, no current practice can be left unexamined without risk. Preparation for the future rests on the willingness to reconstruct the entire conceptual foundation for your life. What is true for the economic pillar also applies to the political, social, and personal pillars, as we shall soon explore. But I digress. Let us return to the economic pillar, to the economic concepts that are required to understand the present and to think prescriptively for the future. The scope of the flat world, of course, is much broader than outsourcing of computer programming and customer service to India. As an example of how companies no longer have international boundaries, consider the emergence of China as a source of a growing proportion of our manufactured goods. This includes high-tech items, not just molded plastics. Thomas Friedman, on page 210, recounts how, on December 7th, 2004, IBM announced it was selling its personal computer division to a Chinese company. The new worldwide PC company would be the third largest in the world, with $12 billion in annual revenue. Friedman writes, I quote, "This new Chinese-owned computer company, headquartered in New York, with factories in Raleigh and Beijing, will have a Chinese chairman, an American chief executive officer, an American chief of operations, and a Chinese chief financial officer, and will be listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange." Close quote. As a result, 10,000 people move from IBM to the Chinese company as their employer. What is the logic behind this kind of arrangement? The simple economic answer is the article of faith that underlies the new economy of a flat world. It is the belief, and I said belief, not fact. It is the belief that capital drives innovation. Innovation drives growth. Growth drives higher individual standards of living. And higher individual standards of living produce the capital necessary to complete the circle, a circle in which everyone is supposed to benefit. Thus, the proposition that both workers and corporations should support free market capitalism in the flat world. The corollary is government regulation creates friction. Friction interferes with innovation and produces inefficiency. Inefficiency and lack of innovation inhibit growth. Lack of growth lowers individual standards of living. Thus, the argument is made that both workers and corporations should oppose socialism in favor of free market capitalism. We shall return many times throughout the podcast to additional examples from Thomas Friedman's book, along with the writing of others. However, the value of Friedman's book is that it summarizes everything you need to understand the economic pillar. The world is flat. There is no corner in which to hide. There is no withdrawal into isolationism. There is now one world market and one economic system for all of the nations of the world. That is the end of the first pillar, the economic. Now, let's turn to the second of the four pillars, the political. The new economic reality that there is one world market and one economic system explains why the political is the second essential pillar. Simply put, in a flat world, all of the nations of the world have a growing vested interest in what goes on in every other nation. In the book Future Tense has the subtitle The Coming World Order. It was written by Gwen Dyer, a Canadian journalist, broadcaster, and lecturer on international affairs. His best-selling book examines how, following the end of the Cold War, there was an orderly, albeit slow, process through the United Nations of creating the capacity for all nations to live together peacefully in the emerging flat world. Dyer called this the Global Project of the United Nations, a project which, in the past, the United States has played an important role. In addition to this global project of the United Nations to abolish war and replace the rule of force with the rule of law, Dyer identified two other global projects. Because of 9/11, we are all familiar with the second one, the Islamic Jihad against the West. The belief within Al-Qaeda was that American retaliation for 9/11 would raise the profile of the radical Islamist cause in the Muslim world, and that Muslims elsewhere, infuriated with the retaliation, would turn to the radical Islamist movement and overthrow their pro-American regimes. Instead, there was widespread support for attacking Osama bin Laden. The sole radical Islamic regime in the entire world was overthrown, and there was not a single Islamic uprising elsewhere. Dyer notes that, no doubt to bin Laden's great surprise and delight, the United States walked deeper into his trap when President Bush decided to invade Iraq. But even still, the Islamists do not command the loyalty of enough people in any Arab country to pull off a successful revolution, and their project remains stuck in the mud. Although enough dead Iraqis and Palestinians may finally fuel the Islamic Jihad movement, but for now the radical Islamist dream of a worldwide jihad against the West is a fantasy. The third global project described by Dyer is the neoconservative foreign policy put into practice by President Bush. Once the Cold War was over, there was no single country that could challenge the military power of the United States. Therefore, the only future threat was from small and vulnerable rogue states that could be quickly taken out. That was when preemptive wars became a possible strategy. On this basis, Bush and the neoconservatives have created what Dyer calls the Pax American Project for the perpetuation of U.S. global domination based on the unilateral exercise of overwhelming American military power. The national security strategy of the United States declares that, and I quote, "The United States will not hesitate to strike preemptively against its enemies and will never again allow its military supremacy to be challenged," close quote. In the long run, this foreign policy is not acceptable to the rest of the world and will be actively resisted by coalitions of other countries with vested interests of their own. Nor is it acceptable to many Americans who feel it is their patriotic duty to help convince the United States to abandon its notion of empire and to return to a more cooperative role that actually reflects the new reality of world interdependence. The terrorist attacks of 9/11 provoked worldwide sympathy and provided even greater urgency for new levels of international political cooperation. Instead, this opportunity was misused by radical extremists in the United States to provide an excuse for evading Iraq and embarking on its unilateral Pax American policy. The implementation of this policy has undermined the United Nations, alienated our traditional allies, widened the gap with Muslim nations, devastated the U.S. economy, and diminished the moral influence of the United States. That policy, Dyer argues, has put at risk the global project to abolish war and replace the rule of force in the world with the rule of law, the project whose centerpiece is the United Nations. This global project and the authority of the United Nations has been abruptly disrupted, not by 9/11, but rather by the reaction to it by the United States. What is most disturbing, Dyer maintains, is not that the United States will be defeated in Iraq, but that it might not be defeated soon enough. We shall return many times throughout this podcast to additional examples from Gwen Dyer's book, along with the writing of others. However, the value of Dyer's book is that it summarizes everything you need to know to understand the political pillar. The future of the world is very tense. Thus the title, Future Tense. The United States cannot run the world as a lone superpower without provoking the rise of competing coalitions and the reemergence of Cold War policies. It is important to remember that the United States has only 4% of the world's population, a declining share of the world's economy, and the world's largest budget and trade deficits, with much of the tab held by China and the oil-producing Arab nations, each with their own political agendas. Dyer notes that the neoconservative project, no less than the radical Islamic Jihad, is the work of fringe groups of extremists in both the Middle East and the United States, who have delivered the world to the brink of disaster. His conclusion is, quote, "The world needs the United States back as the leading architect of global order, not as a hyperactive vigilante, and the world needs it back now." That finishes the description of the second pillar, the political. Consider now the third of the four pillars, the social pillar. Jared Diamond is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Collapse: How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. He is also author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. In both books, he combines geography, history, and evolutionary biology to capture the dynamic forces that account for the rise and fall of civilizations from prehistoric times to the present. More than any other scholar, he has written in simple and direct prose about the complex history and experience of humankind on this planet. In his newest book, Collapse, he asks two questions. First, why have some civilizations managed to survive for thousands of years, even under some of the most marginal conditions, and others collapsed in far shorter time span, even under much more favorable conditions for human existence? And second, what are the implications of our current situation as we move toward an increasingly flat and technologically advanced modern world? Of course, there's no definitive answer to these two questions, and a comparison of the present with the past can always be dismissed with, "That was then, and this is now. Everything is different. Now we have science and technology to solve any problem." Well, maybe so, and maybe not. As a sobering thought, consider that, in the grand sweep of time, the story of the European settlement in the New World is still out. The less than 600 years since Columbus arrived is a far shorter period of time than the gradual rise and then sudden collapse of other complex civilizations. Yet, some of the similarities are remarkably familiar, such as exhausting a resource, say trees or energy, necessary to maintain a growing population until the resource was gone. The result, then, being a rapid decline and the social disintegration of what was a complex cooperative society, as people killed each other to be among the few who survive. One of the many stories that Diamond tells is the history of Easter Island. Easter Island is a 66 square mile island in a remote area of the Pacific, roughly 1,000 miles from both Chile and the larger Polynesian islands from which the first settlers came in about 800 AD. At that time, it was a lush island, green with trees, with plentiful seafood, good soil for agriculture. Today, it is virtually a deserted island, without trees, but with the visible remains of what was once a remarkable and complex society. There are over 300 huge stone statues, some 30 feet tall, with 10-ton pieces of carved rock placed on the top. All were constructed without cranes and with only simple hand tools. Visitors are struck in awe about how this could be. Where are the people? Well, the people have long gone, since about 1700 A.D., when the society collapsed. It has taken years of archaeological study to put together the story of what happened. Every tree had been cut down, the soil had washed away, all of the nesting birds on the island extinguished from over-harvesting, the inshore fishing depleted, and no wood left for building ocean-going boats to do offshore fishing. What was once an island with distinct clans and chiefs that traded goods such as fish, crops, and lumber from one part of the island to the other had fallen into total collapse. Simply put, the people on Easter Island grew in response to the abundance, but as their numbers grew at an accelerating rate, the abundance declined at an accelerating rate. Each tree that was cut down contributed to the soil erosion that reduced the crops. That in turn led to overfishing and overharvesting of the nesting birds, thus deepening the problem. The ever grander and larger statues that were constructed by competing chiefs diverted more and more manpower away from productive work. While the construction and transportation of the statues consumed the trees at a far greater rate than they were replaced by regrowth. Diamond could not resist drawing a parallel between the chiefs and their statues with the Hollywood Mongols living near his home in Los Angeles, who displayed their wealth in a similar way by building larger and more ostentatious houses than each other. Both reflect the gradual evolution of a complex, class-bound society with larger and larger disparities of wealth and power between the upper and the lower classes. Diamond ends his account of Easter Island with the following, I quote, "The Easter Islanders' isolation probably also explains why I have found that their collapse, more than the collapse of any other pre-industrial society, haunts my readers and students. The parallels between Easter Island and the whole modern world are chillingly obvious. Thanks to globalization, international trade, jet planes, and the internet, all countries on Earth today share resources that affect each other, just as did Easter's dozen clans. Polynesian Easter Island was as isolated in the Pacific Ocean as the Earth is today in space. When the Easter Islanders got into difficulty, there was nowhere to which they could flee, nor to which they could turn for help. Nor shall we modern Earthlings have recourse elsewhere if our troubles increase. Those are the reasons why people see the collapse of Easter Island society as a metaphor, a worst-case scenario, for what may lie ahead of us in our own future." It's on page 119, close quote. We shall return many times throughout the podcast to additional examples, and particularly modern examples, from Jared Diamond's book, along with the writing of others. However, the value of Diamond's book is that it summarizes everything you need to know to understand the social pillar, how societies choose to fail or succeed. The key word is choose. The future is not predetermined. It will be determined by the choices we, the adults of today, make. For the youth of today, it is your future, and the making of it is now. Thus, I have entitled this podcast, Forums for a Future, the necessary discussions about the economic, political, and social realities of today in order to have a personal tomorrow. That ends the description of the third pillar, the social. The fourth and last pillar is the personal pillar. It is, after all, individual people who live in the world. As structural concepts, the economic, political, and social are impersonal. They do not eat, sleep, fight, or raise families. People do that all over the world, and they have thoughts and feelings about the economic, political, and social events with which they must cope. As an example, consider the point and counterpoint of the social and economic pillars. The basic concept of the social pillar, just illustrated by Easter Island, is that unregulated growth can lead to the spectacular rise of a civilization through innovation and through surplus productivity sufficient to produce a complex social structure in which the labor of some people are freed to assume other roles, such as statue builders, Hollywood moguls, and yes, even soldiers. But the division of labor and the resulting class structure can also be the seeds for an inevitable collapse once the tipping point of sustainability is crossed. Specifically, how many statues, moguls, warriors can the labor of others support? In contrast, the basic concept of the economic pillar is that capitalism drives innovation, innovation drives growth, growth drives higher individual levels of standards of living, and everyone benefits in both the present and indefinitely into the future. Both cannot be true. Yet, it is individual people who will make the decisions on which civilizations fail or succeed, and who will experience the consequences of how those forces play themselves out through political processes. Thus, the fourth pillar is the psychology of the individual, because it is people who are the players and the ultimate source of responsibility. In the end, every decision and every human experience will reside within someone who has a name, an address, and a role. We are those people, you, I, and everyone else. Each of us are caught in the economic, political, and social web. Some of us will lose our jobs, while others will become very rich. Some will support spending money for social service programs, while others will suggest tax cuts will have a more beneficial effect. Some of us will die in Iraq, while others will protest the war. Some of us alive today will choose to become suicide bombers, while others will volunteer for the U.S. Armed Forces and will also die. Some of us will make decisions we feel are providing leadership, while others will feel powerless and shapeless in the hands of fate. The personal and the psychological are my areas of expertise. This pillar, the personal, is what I will bring to the podcast as my scholarly contribution. My professional work has been on the psychological aspects of social issues, specifically how economic, political, and social structures create the social issues and the social conditions with which people must cope. In short, it is about the psychology of change, both the adaptations people must make in response to external events and the role they can play in shaping and determining their own future. The first is internal and inward, and is based on the thoughts and feelings through which we understand ourselves. The second is external and outward, and is based on the behaviors and expectations through which we express and thus know ourselves. The personal pillar is our individual place in the sun. We are both responsible for and the recipients of our future. This must necessarily be cross-generational, because every present is someone else's past or future, as is true for each of us. This ends the podcast for today. The economic, political, social, and personal are the four pillars on which the podcast series is built. This ends part one of the series. The next podcast will begin part two, which is entitled A Philosophy for the 21st Century. Part two will provide the perspective for how to get from the present to a future we will be proud to give to our children and to our children's children.
How many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is glowing.
No, it is not 1960, and I am not living in the past. It's nearly one half of a century later, and I am looking into the future. There's an urgency now to finish what was started then. It has taken another war, another replay of Vietnam, to bring us full circle. But this time, there is the absolute necessity of putting into practice what was then seen as the exuberance of idealistic youth. Well, it's no longer youthful idealism. It is our new reality for both the youth and the adults of today. Either we embrace fundamental economic, political, social, and personal change, or we will forfeit our collective future. The youth and the adults of today have common cause for a cross-generational commitment, a commitment by the youth to lay claim to a viable future, a commitment by adults to revisit the idealism of their past, this time for actually creating a sustainable future. What an exciting time to be alive.
We can hear people cry. How many deaths will it take till he knows that to many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing.